Welcome to Stuck in My Mind podcast, the show where we dive into the mind of a regular guy on his road to self-discovery. You'll hear everyday people just like you share the latest topics, personal stories, and things they've learned along the way. And now, please welcome your host, Wise.
Thank you, Wise. It's great to be here. Happy to be sharing some time with you. And you want to know right up top what the secret of my success is? I can give it to you in four words. I didn't know this
and
was my operating
welcome
system,
to another episode. I have a very special guest
outcomes.
On today. He's
if you don't
done
fear
so
bad
many
outcomes,
things in his life.
Anything
I just I don't even know where to start. He's an author. He's
history,
a writer.
A
he's written books on poker. He's written for
progress. Where times
for Married with Children. Charles in Charge. This man has been everywhere.
A candidate.
Welcome to the show,
job prospect,
John Voorhaus.
Someone who could do the work. Whether I thought I could do the work or not, I put myself out there that way because I figured the worst that could happen is it wouldn't go completely great and I'd learn something along the way.
A lot of things, man.
But that it's not fearlessness because fearlessness exists in the face of adverse consequences. It's more a matter of realizing that in most circumstances, the things we think are adverse consequences and the things that stop us from making progress don't really exist in the way we think of them.
It's your boy, W-I-Z-E. And today's show is sponsored by Bergen Basin Realty. If you're looking to sell anywhere in the New York City area, definitely check them out. Bergen Basin Realty has been providing professional real estate services in the Brooklyn area for over 40 years. They have an impeccable reputation built on honesty, integrity, and service. Bergen Basin Realty's influence stretches far beyond Bergen Beach. Their comprehensive network of referral systems, professional affiliations, and solid internet marketing strategies consistently drive traffic to all their listings. So check out their website at www.bergenbasin.com. Give them a call at 718-763-4110 or send them an email at bergenbasin@aol.com and let them know that your boy Y sent you. Peace out. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Definitely. Right. It's just for me when I shifted my mind, the way I was thinking and stop being afraid of, because I had been wanting to do a podcast for over a year and I made up excuses in my head. Every excuse, I sound horrible. Who would want to listen to me?
There's a book called
Why Would I Want to
the
Do
Artist's
This?
Way.
And it took me to really
point that
step
people
out
are
of my
of
comfort zone,
art
face
they think
the
they're
fear,
not be any good at
and
it
not be afraid to fail,
because
that's what
they
it was.
Really aren't
I,
very good at
my, my
but
thing
she
was.
Says the logic
was
of that is like saying, I didn't better not
fail.
Try to learn French because
but
I don't know French.
I had already failed because
you don't know French.
I didn't try.
Why should you be afraid of not doing French?
I just said, you know what?
And everybody can see the logic
record,
of that, of course. I don't know the vocabulary. I don't know the grammar.
It was like,
if I want to learn it, I have to accept that my learning curve will be steep and my progress
creativity
will be
just started flowing
start.
And I just started doing
so
many different things.
Subjects,
that
but when we look at ourselves
like,
through
man,
our artistic
done this a long time
or creative
ago.
Lens,
but that's what it is. We get afraid and we don't know what to do.
Fear lens, and that's when we start to see things, get arguments in our head that don't really make sense, but they're very persuasive and very powerful. In my book, The Comic Toolbox, I describe this force as the fraud police, the sense that if I'm in a writer's room or if I'm teaching a class or any place that I'm putting myself on the line creatively, I'm afraid that the door is going to burst open and the fraud police are going to come charging in, armed and dangerous, and saying, come quietly now, Mr. Voorhaus. If you just leave quietly, no one will get hurt. Now, obviously, that's a construct in my mind. It's not reality. It's not going to happen. But if that concern is large enough and powerful enough in my mind, it'll freeze me to inactivity. So I try to dismiss the fraud police from my thinking wherever I can. I have to tell you, I presented this material once overseas for a group of people who didn't speak English all that well. And after class, somebody came up to me and said, these frog police of which you speak, what are the frog police? I said, it has nothing to do with frogs. That's just a translation error. That's a great question, isn't it? As you know from my CV, and as I will now tell your listeners, I wrote for the original Married with Children back in the 1980s, just briefly. I had a sitcom career that spanned about a decade or so, but along the way I was developing my teaching chops, and I wrote a book called The Comic Toolbox, How to Be Funny Even If You're Not. And that book has found its way to all corners of the world, including it found its way to the desk of the vice president of Sony Pictures International at a time when I was working in Romania. Yeah. I reached out to him.
It's cool because I see you've done so many different things.
If you ever have any opportunities for me, I'd love to put my hat in the ring
and become on the writing staff on the Russian version of
qualified to do what I wanted to do. So he assigned me to the Russian version of Married with Children, and I spent two winters in Moscow running the writing staff of that show. What's interesting about it is, in the American version of Married with Children, it took 13 years to spin out all the seasons, all the episodes, 22 or 23 a year, something like that. But the Russians had a different model. They were producing two episodes every 2 weeks and airing them two or three times a week. So they burned through all 13 seasons of Married with Children, adapting the episodes one by one. And then they ran out. They didn't have any more episodes to do, so they started writing new ones. And that's when Sony brought me in to help them develop new stories and scripts for the Russian versions of the Married with Children characters. Who, by the way, I've traveled all over the world, and every time I tell somebody that I write for Married with Children, no matter what country I'm in, everybody says, oh, he's that Al Bundy. He's just like us. So there really is something universal about this bitter loser character that other people in other countries can easily relate to. Well, hoping for the best and expecting the worst and never being disappointed, because his expectations were always met. But here's what's interesting about that.
Oh, yeah. Growing up, it was one of my favorite shows.
Who are completely dysfunctional. We get that.
And the seductive promise of television. Just the way him.
Especially
the chemistry between him
and
Peg was just crazy.
Look at this picture of your reality. Okay, it seems not your reality.
And that's not how, like,
I
look at my marriage now. And there's nothing like there.
But now look at this family and ask yourself one question. If they
it was funny the dynamics of Al coming home from work, not really expecting a home cooked meal, he already knew what he had, but it was just crazy.
I think that's really what a show like Married with Children does for us. It holds up a funhouse mirror to our own reality, and it basically says, if these jokers can cope with that, you can easily cope with what you have going on. And I think people find that to be a very seductive and inviting message, and that's why it works so well. I developed a television show, and I worked on a project, I would say, in Norway, and it was the story of a teenage girl and her alcoholic mother. And her alcoholic mother was a piece of work. I mean, she was the most embarrassing, humiliating, mortifying, bad mother that any girl could have. So yeah, the story of a teenage girl dealing with all teenage anxieties, on top of which she has the world's worst mother, like her worst enemy and her worst nightmare are right there under her roof. And I think that for teenage girls dealing with their own mothers, who might be quite normal mothers, but still you're a teenager and you're dealing with your parents, it's always a challenging. I think it's really gratifying that you can look at somebody else's relationship and say, well, those people, they've got it a lot worse than I have. And if they can manage, I guess I can too. So we see that over and over again. Mm-hmm. Another sort of serendipitous story. Again, kind of goes back to the comic toolbox. I was working in Los Angeles and also traveling and teaching writers overseas. And a woman from Nicaragua came to the U.S. to study comedy writing, sitcom, at the American Film Institute. But the class that she intended to take had been canceled. So the American Film Institute asked me if I would step in and just help her one-on-one. And it didn't take more than a meeting for me to realize that there was a possibility for me to do a lot of powerful good in Nicaragua if I was willing to wade into the project.
I found this very interesting,
be part
too.
Of it. Because
you did
this wasn't
two social action TV
television
dramas
situation.
In Nicaragua?
It wasn't a network or a production company. It was a social action group, a nonprofit organization with a very strong leftist, feminist, championing of young people, anti-violence, anti-sexism, racism, homophobia, very, very strong social agenda. And they wanted to do a show that, as I later described it, would teach the young people of Nicaragua to think for themselves and practice safe sex. And it was really, really powerful and successful social modeling, not just in Nicaragua, but throughout South and Central America, such that we ended up making another program. But all along the way, I realized that considering the the urgent needs in the country and the lack of skills for telling stories in the country, the only way my part of the project was going to work was if I really committed to it in a way that I hadn't previously committed to greater good kind of projects. And it taught me a lot about how an engagement can be satisfying to me because it exists at the intersection of my passion and purpose. And this is the part that I'd like to share. If I'd gone to Nicaragua to build houses, that might have been serving a purpose, building houses, serving the people of Nicaragua. But it wouldn't be engaging my passion because I have no passion for building houses. I'm very bad at carpentry. But I do have a passion for writing, and I have a very strong passion for teaching writers. So for me to go to Nicaragua and invest my skills and my energy in a project that exists right at the intersection of my passion and purpose, my desire to help writers and my desire to be a force for social good, that made the experience really easy and fun and harmonious for me. And so for anybody who's listening and is wondering, how can I align my creative energies so they really serve me? So they really serve. No worries. It's the pandemic. It's the post-pandemic. Anyway, if I'm looking for a way to really energize my creative practice and align it so that it will operate effectively, I just look for the intersection of passion and purpose. And every time I find those two things, something I want to contribute to, plus skills that I enjoy using, that's a powerful math. That will take you far.
I'm recording. I can't if I'm recording. Sorry about that.
Only 10 or 11. It sort of depends how you count. Because I got one book on strip poker that's really not a book. It's more just a deck of cards with a pamphlet. Sexy deck of cards, though. I've written, easily 10 books on poker, a bunch of how-to books, and several novels, and then some novelty projects like that strip poker kit. This is kind of another easily extracted lesson, if I may. When poker got awesome. Hot in the early 2000s, I was writing early, different kinds of things, teaching and training, always looking for exciting opportunities. And when poker really started to take off, one thing that interests me is, and I said, you know, I'm already writing for poker magazines at this point. I think I could sell a book in this market. And he said something I'll never forget, and it really changed my life forever. He said, I don't think I can sell one book, but I know I can sell three. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I have a publisher who will buy a series of books for you. Your Killer Poker brand, it's established, and they'll be happy to roll out at least three books in the series. And I said to him, well, that's all well and good, but I don't have three books worth of poker to talk about. He said, sure you do. You just don't know it yet. And he was absolutely right, because once I signed the contract to deliver three book-length manuscripts every 6 months, it just put my feet to the fire. I had to study the game that much more deeply. I had to figure out new ways of talking about new topics. And I just had to have the discipline of being a day in and day out writer in a way that I hadn't experienced before. So I was engaging in projects that were going to take me 6 months to a year to execute. And I wasn't sure I could do it. I had some fear, some anxiety. And I realized that's just part of the practice. Everybody's got those fears every time we try to do something we haven't done before. But I burned through those three books, and they liked them so much, and the market was so hot that they bought another three books. So it turns out I had six books in the Killer Poker series by the time all was said and done, and never ran out of things to say. What I didn't realize was, even as I was learning about poker and teaching poker, the game was changing. So things that I wrote in 2002 had been completely transformed by 2006 or 2007 and needed rethinking and readdressing, because it's just in the nature of poker. The game is constantly changing as players adjust, develop new strategies, and develop adjustments to those strategies, adjust off the adjustments, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that was a real revenue driver for me all through the early 2000s. I could count on those books to be to generate a living in advances for a bunch of years. And then it was just put my nose to the grindstone and do the work, which is all I wanted to do anyhow. Mm-hmm. Well, this was a pandemic project, I'm sure. Your podcast was a pandemic project, wasn't it? Or was it? Yes, it was. Yeah. What happened with the pandemic, and everybody who's listening can relate to this, I'm sure, in a direct way. As a group, I'm speaking now of creative practitioners, people who have a desire to be creative. As a group, like we were shell shocked.
That's
we were confronted.
So,
with
all right, I also see that we also no you're also very over. Into charity events and stuff like that. You did create self portraits in 100 days for Doctors
back.
Without Borders.
We had to speak creatively to this thing that we couldn't control, because our creative response was the only thing that we could control.
Yes, it was.
And
it was.
Not it just me, everybody, not just you, everybody had the same urge. I have to answer COVID-19. Early in the pandemic, I did a series of writing workshops that involved writing a comic letter to COVID-19, a 500-word letter intended to be funny, but mostly just intended to give writers a chance to address their feelings about COVID-19 and the pandemic and the changes that it was requiring of them. There's a saying in writing, the truth is revealed under pressure. That's kind of a secret of storytelling. But in real life, we were all under pressure that we'd never, ever encountered before. And it confronted us and required that we discover new truths about ourselves. Now, for myself, at that time, I was very close to calling myself an artist. I wasn't yet calling myself an artist. I was calling myself a wannabe artist or a practitioner. I had only been doing art for a few years and hadn't quite gotten over the hurdle of allowing myself to define myself as someone who has visual capability, artistic capability. Been a writer all my life, been an artist for 10 minutes, scared as usual. But the pandemic is here and it requires a response from me. So I said to myself, I'm going to take on the following challenge. I'm going to do 100 self-portraits in 100 days and post them every day on Facebook and do it as a fundraiser for Doctors Without Borders. Now, I dealt in a lot of self-protection in this task. Making it a fundraiser protected my ego from anybody saying, why are you wasting your time doing this? Your efforts aren't very good. We don't like you. None of this happened, but it was in my mind. It's a common fear. But doing it as a fundraiser for a charity gave me a rationale. I could say to the world, like my art or don't like my art, you can't dislike my intention. So if you think my intention is good, whether you like my art or not, you can still support my intention by supporting Doctors Without Borders. So I use Doctors Without Borders to give a social framework to my work, but mostly to set myself up for success, because in this sense of it's a charity, it's for a good cause, that gave me a lot more freedom to create. And I told you I protected myself in several ways. The other way I protected myself might seem counterintuitive, but I made this a daily project. I have to turn in work every single day, which means nothing that I work on can linger too long, which means that I can't be too precious about the choices I'm making. I have to make choices fast. I have to execute on them fast. Then I have to stand by the choices that I've made, throw them out there to the public, and see what happens with them. That pressure of producing every day completely set me free from any concerns I might have about, is this good enough? Is that good enough? There wasn't so much time to worry about good enough. The requirement was a new self-portrait today and go. And by the way, I chose to do self-portraits not because I'm massively narcissistic, although I am, but also because I knew that I could count on myself to be a reliable model and subject for my work. I'd never say no to me to pose one more time. So that's all the thinking behind that project. Hugely successful in the sense that I raised some money for Doctors Without Borders, but in the deeper sense, I'm now an artist. I know I am. I have artistic achievement. I've won attaboys, I won't say prizes, enthusiastic responses for a lot of my work, and I've gotten into some gallery shows with those 100 heads or with different ones of them, because obviously some are stronger than others. But I came through the experience and came out of it saying, not only was that creatively rewarding, it was a real step up in my practice. And that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm always looking for myself. And I'm always trying to help other creative people, writers or artists achieve, which is a step up in your practice. We we get hung up thinking about the end result. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be a made guy. I'm going to change the world. All of that stuff kind of takes us away from the main thing, which is just growing our craft, focusing our practice, trying to get better at the things that we want to get good at. That's kind of been my message in all of my how-to books, and it continues to be the message in the work I'm working on now, which is called The Little Book of Stand-Up. It's going to be a small practice-driven book on stand-up comedy. So, yeah. I gave you a lot of answer there.
Well, for me, I've added so many different titles in the last year, just from starting my podcast. I've added editor, I've added producer, I've added CEO. It's just so many different things just from the podcast, just from me. Stepping out of my comfort zone and doing something that I had been procrastinating. You invented procrastination. I'm saying procrastination because that's what I was doing, was procrastinating and making up excuses. But again, once I started, it's like creative juices started flowing. So many different ideas. Hey, I can do this. I can do that. I'm about to launch a radio station, which has been in the work for the last year, but I didn't want to release it until, like, I did a soft launch in January where we just played music. But my whole idea was to have original content on there, or have podcasters come on and release their shows on there as well, and have platforms for musicians and artists to come on and perform their music.
Well,
and even stand-up comedy, comedians come on and do a 30-minute set and play it out live on the station.
A lot of places in the world where uncensored content is not possible.
I just wanted to give creators another content, especially now with especially for podcasters now with
Apple and all these battle between good and evil, maybe between order and chaos. Platforms,
subscription method,
but. I was writing
who
about
knows
this
what kind of things
so
what
I'm
kind
a
of regulations
comic. I'm a recreational
have,
stand-up kind of, comic, but I'm writing to stand-up comics.
What kind of standards are you gonna have? So people
my
might be censored in a way. So I just felt that maybe
like,
by me doing this,
one
I
of
can
the
give people an outlet
key questions
being
that
censored.
Confronts comics
like,
these days
if you release
is,
something on
what do
YouTube
I do about political correctness?
They don't
what do I do about punching
it,
down,
down,
bullying, body shaming? Where is my voice allowed to be in a social landscape that's changing so quickly that I don't know where I am anymore? And this is of no small consideration to me because I'm a 65-year-old white guy standing on a mountain of privilege, and I'm aware of it in ways that I wasn't aware of it before. But it's not really problem-solving to say to a stand-up comic or somebody who wants to speak to the human condition, it doesn't really solve their problem to say, be considerate or watch what you say or think about your impact. That those are all strategies for dealing with the situation, but they don't really get to the heart of it. Here's the heart of it. As creators, we're either one of two things. We're either builder-uppers or kicker-downers. We either build things up or we kick them down. And in the creative process, both voices are necessary. We need people in their words and their art to say to the world is a great place, aspire to more, cherish beauty, rise up. But we also need iconoclasts. We need critics. We need angry voices. We need people whose job it is to cast down the idols, to break things. So there is a place in creative practice for knocker-downers. All that's really required of an individual, of a creator, is to ask the simple question, which am I? Am I a builder-upper or am I a knocker-downer? Recognizing that both choices are valid, but once you've made the choice and you know where you stand, then suddenly you no longer have any questions about what's appropriate to your brand, what's appropriate to your voice, because you know what your goal is, broadly speaking, to lift up or to knock down. When you have that piece of information, then the whole political correctness space gets much easier to deal with. For myself, I know I'm never entering that space except with a desire to contribute, to lift up. So I can look at material that I'm writing and I can ask myself, is this joke going to work the way I want it to? Is it going to be interpreted as a call to collective action, or is it going to be interpreted as a criticism or a negative? If it's the former, it belongs in my act. If it's the latter, it's never going to be there and I don't have to worry about it. So that's the kind of thing I'm always looking for in my work, controlling ideas that fix a lot of small problems. And that's one.
Yeah, that's cool. That's good, man. That's definitely something I like to have people on to who are about creating positive content and who are looking to help people. And that's why when I first started, it was all about ranting and raving about politics and my job and all that. And I was not happy doing that. I was not happy. It wasn't until I got to speak to people and interview people and hear their stories
and hear what they've overcome the or what they've done to improve their life. I'm specifically interested in helping people.
That's where
like
I really
this.
Started having more
people
fun
who
in my
want
podcast.
To have a
that's
creative
where I was
practice,
like, this is what I want. This is how I want to do it.
But don't yet and, have
and since then,
the
I've just, that's what
momentum
I've been doing
to get over that first
speaking
hurdle.
Speaking to amazing people like
to
yourself.
Get from not writing to writing.
And
to
being
get from
able
not
to
making
prick
art,
your brain and talk
art,
to you and learn.
Not podcasting to podcasting.
And just have some
the first step
great
is the
conversations.
In retrospect, it'll
because
turn out
that's
to
what
be
I felt that
small step.
I needed to
look
put
back
out there.
And say, why
just
did that
positive
ever stop
content,
me?
Just nothing
it was
but
really
positivity.
Pretty simple once I got rolling.
Where someone,
but
if someone
that,
hears my episode and it helped them out in
and,
some way, I feel like I did
how
what
to
I was
manage
supposed to do.
The relationship between fear and expectation. You kind of have to go through these things before you can even start your practice. Otherwise, you're so burdened by how awful it's going to be for so long that you just never do anything at all. And my heart goes out to those people in particular, people like yourself in the before times who wanted a practice, wanted to be out there contributing to the greater good, but hadn't quite, it's not a question, hadn't found your voice, hadn't yet owned your voice. Once we take ownership of our creative voice, then the fear goes down, it doesn't go away, but we have another weapon against it. Because then we can say to ourselves in our inner dialogue, look, fear, I know you're there, but I'm serving a higher purpose now. I'm making my voice heard because I want to communicate X or Y ideas to people. And that need is so great that I can't let even you, my biggest fears, stop me. So motivation, desire, intention, those become weapons that we use in our constant war against fear, doubt, and insecurity. And then we just go to war day in and day out. You know, no, sorry. I was just going to say, I did. I what I admire
like that.
About
I
that
definitely
is,
like
is you
that.
Put the first
I,
work
I
up
go to
there
war
and
every
you
day,
left
man.
It up there and you stood behind
I
it.
I attacked this like
when
there
I
is
first
no
started
tomorrow,
doing art. I started art at the age of 60.
That's how I feel. That's why I've improved and why my shows numbers have gone up. It's because I'm being consistent. Because I'm putting out
shows
regularly.
And of course, being a writer, I immediately turned around and wrote a book
on it
called A White Belt,
which was 5 minutes and wasn't the greatest quality. But I left it on there so that people can see my growth from episode 1 to whatever episode I'm up to now, which is like 97, 98.
And not in a pretty way often. I look at those now and I say, you must have had some kind of balls to put these bad drawings and bad artistic renderings into a book. What were you thinking? And the answer is, I was thinking to record my journey so that somebody else could come along behind me and say, well, if this joker can do this art and then teach from it, effectively, because here I am learning from it, then I guess if he's telling me that I can do it too, maybe I can do it too. And once again, I've liberated somebody from their fear of executing on their art just by being willing to showcase mine, warts and all. I do a similar thing when I'm teaching comedy writing classes. When I'm teaching comedy, there's a tremendous amount of insecurity because these are people who want to be funny. They're not sure they're funny. They know people are going to be judging them. There's a lot of failure vibe in the room. So pretty early on in my presentations, I make a mistake on purpose. I tell a joke that doesn't work, or I flub a line or something that's manifestly a mistake. And then I say to the audience, I just made this mistake and I made it on purpose. Let me tell you why. Because I'm the teacher, I'm the expert, and I'm supposed to be perfect, right? But here I am making mistakes. I'm showcasing mistakes. I'm modeling failure. And if you think about your reaction, audience, you'll see at this moment, you don't hate me. You actually like me more because I'm willing to own my mistakes. I'm willing to own failure. So if the guy who's teaching the class is willing to own failure, what does that say about the people taking the class? That they have complete freedom to own failure, because the authority in the room has already acknowledged that failure is part of the process, and failure is not to be shunned, but to embrace, to be embraced. And at this point, I always usually add, if you must fail, and you will fail, fail big, because it will have been a failure, but it might be a spectacular one, and there's always value in doing spectacular things. All right. Okay, here we go. The key to the Voorhaus Empire begins with the correct spelling of my surname. My full name is John Voorhaus, JohnVoorhaus. When you have those words, you can find your way to johnvoorhaus.com, where you can find a great number of my books, electronic versions and print versions for sale. I can do signed first editions and send them out in the mail, but also there are PDFs for download at a reasonable price.
So
when you have my name, John Voorhaus,
John, let them know where they can find you at. What's your website? Where you can plug away.
Just
let them know.
Amazon and type in John Voorhaus in books.
What social media?
Find it all.
Anything.
All
anything. Just plug away. Let them know where they can find you.
All the books that Amazon carries, all the books from all of my publishers can be found on Amazon.com. I don't get the same cut that I get when you buy them from my website directly, but not all of my books are available through my website directly. So between those two resources, my website and Amazon, you can find everything you need. If you are a fan of audiobooks, I just want to mention that after 10 years, I finally retrieved the rights to four of my author-narrated audiobooks. These are books that I recorded about 10 years ago, and for one reason or another, haven't been in the marketplace. The best of the best is a book called The Little Book of Sitcom. If you're interested in writing situation comedy, you get the author narrated version of this work in your ear. That's going to be a lot of fun for you, I'm told, with all due false modesty, that that's a really good listen because it's author narrated and I seem to know what I'm talking about. The other gem among there is my novel, Lucy in the Sky. This is a hippie novel set in Milwaukee in hippie times. And it's great for author-narrated audio for the following reason. The climax of the book is an extended acid trip. And if you don't have direct experience of that as a narrator, I don't think you can read the prose or narrate it with the right kind of intensity and craziness that it demands. But because of my life experiences and my work as an author and a practitioner and a creative explorer, I have all the authority I need to narrate that portion of the book with the excitement and the, let's say, the displaced reality that it demands. So that one more thing, in my artistic practice, I have put a lot of my images on redbubble.com, and there you can get JV art on mugs and t-shirts and backdrops and shower curtains, and it got everything you can think of. So if you go to redbubble.com and search again for my name, John Voorhaus, that'll take you to my Redbubble shop, where you can get just stunningly colorful images and some funny ones and some real mind scrapers that'll look great on t-shirts. You'll walk around and people will look at you and they'll say, where did you get that wacky piece of business? And you'll say, I know, right? And that'll be the end of that conversation. And that's the end of my plug. Oh, sorry. It's not complete. No, sorry. It's not completely the end. There's one more thing I have to mention. I am in service to new writers, new creative people of all kinds. Guys, if you got a question that you think I can help you with, reach out to me directly. Go to my website, send me an email, send me from the contact link on my website. I'm always interested in hearing people from people who I can help. So, and that's for real. So that's just generosity of spirit right there. And that's the end of my spiel.
All right, John. Thank you, John. I appreciate you being on, man. But now it's time for shout outs. Big shout out to my man, Steve Joyner, for definitely setting up another great interview. I appreciate you, brother. Big shout out to my Real Wise family, King Says, Poppy J, Brandy J. Big shout out to my homie, Chrissy Richards from Cypher Knowledge with Chrissy. Big shout out to the boss lady, Fina. I love you, baby. And as always, a big, big shout out to all the essential workers out there. God bless you. Be safe. Your boy Wise is out. Peace out.
Thanks for listening. Listen on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, and TuneIn. Find us on social media on Twitter at @Wise_B_Blunt, Instagram at @Wise_B_Blunt, and a Facebook fan page, www.facebook.com/Wise76. Check back soon for new episodes. Until next time, peace out.